You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 8th of April 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. Well, once again, I am very pleased to say that I have my co-host with me here today, Mr. Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. It's been a very pleasant morning, albeit that it's been a bit wet so far. We've had alternating periods of overcast clouds and lashing rain, but it seems to be drying up now, so let's look forward to the afternoon.
Yeah, most bizarre weather. I mean, we were talking about it warming up and it being springtime, and then there was snow on the hills near me the other day. But yeah, it's nice and sunny today, and we say we were looking forward to some good weather. We were looking forward to leaving the EU, and that just hasn't happened. We made predictions last week that what would end up happening would either be that we end up in the European Union elections, in which case Tommy Robinson would end up being voted in, or May would eventually have to say that she is going to not trigger Article 50, but actually leave the EU. And both of those outcomes, I think, are pretty good. And now she's thrown a spanner in the works by trying to work with Jeremy Corbyn, and she's basically thrown her own Conservative Party under the bus. They're all furious at her. She's saying that she's now going to be working with Jeremy Corbyn to come to some kind of compromise, which means that what we will have there is a soft Brexit deal. She's now begging for an extension to the other EU states, an extension to Article 50. And they may not go along with this because they know full well that what that means, if we vote in EU elections, it does mean Nigel Farage and Tommy Robinson and lots of other Eurosceptics, which they really don't want. And May has admitted that, yes, we will be voting in the EU elections. Plus, on top of that, we've also got the leader of the English Democrats Party, who has taken out something to do with the High Court. It's a High Court appeal, basically stating that in law we actually left the European Union last Friday, and that because Theresa May hasn't enacted a new law or a new Act of Parliament, then everything that she has done since then has just been pantomime. It's just been for the viewers to think that we're still within the EU, and in actual fact we have left. And there is a good chance that could end up being upheld by the judges. So that's another thing that could happen. So we've got four things here to really sort of talk about to do with Brexit. Plus, we've also got where the Conservative Party are now so furious at Theresa May. The activists have all gone on strike. All the donations have dried up. I mean, we really are living in strange times here, Max. I know you've been looking into this as well. You've been looking into the withdrawal agreement. What do you think of Theresa May begging for this extension to voting in the EU elections first, I guess, is what we should discuss, this extension that she's asked for?
Well, Theresa May just appears to be floundering around. As each week goes by, she seems to flounder even more desperately. And now she's entered into talks with Jeremy Corbyn. And it's interesting, actually, that Jeremy Corbyn has always positioned himself as a conviction politician in the past. And in the past, he's always been anti the European Union on the basis that it is a kind of a globalist capitalist entity. And it's interesting that now he is toying with the idea of saving Theresa May by entering into some kind of agreement with her to keep us effectively in the European Union. Because as far as Theresa May's agreement is concerned, it is Brexit in name only, and it will mean that we will continue to we'll just effectively become a satellite state of the European Union with no ability to influence the European Union, but in a situation where we are forced to follow their laws and to implement all of their environmental competition and tax harmonization regulations. And so it is interesting to watch. And I think that as far as the Conservative Party is concerned, what Theresa May really needs to focus on, I think, is the fact that the vast majority, the grassroots members of the Conservative Party, are a lot more right-wing than she is, and a lot more right-wing than, in fact, even people like Boris Johnson are, and that there could well be a very large backlash. And you've already mentioned the fact that I think it's 100 constituencies have said that they will stop campaigning now, but local constituencies have said they'll stop campaigning for the Conservative Party if there is a general election called, and during the European elections, if they're called, and this could spread. I've had years and years of experience of being a polling agent during elections for the BNP, amongst others, and I've stood outside polling stations, and I've had conversations throughout the long sort of dull hours of the day when we've been waiting for people to come to vote, because quite often there are long periods in between groups of voters coming to vote when you're just standing there idly doing nothing. And so I've entered into conversations with lots of people, both within the Labour Party and within the Conservative Party. And my experience is that both Labour Party members and Conservative Party rank and file members are far more right wing than their leadership would like to believe. And I've had members of the Labour Party, in fact, claiming that they wholly support BNP policy, but they just continue to support the Labour Party because their parents did. It's a kind of tribal thing. And the same goes with the Conservative Party. You know, there are people who have absolutely loathe the current liberal left leadership of the Conservative Party, but who don't speak out just purely because they don't, as far as they're concerned, the Conservative Party has become a kind of a social club, and they don't want to risk being thrown out and ostracized by this social club by speaking out too vehemently against the leadership. But Theresa May could be in for a big surprise, particularly if enough people speak out and enough of the public begin to realise just how great the betrayal that's taking place actually is.
Well, I think that's always actually been one good thing about having European Union MPs, because that has always stood as a protest vote. So people that would normally vote for Labour or would vote for Conservative and will never actually stop voting for them in general elections, when they have the European Union election, that gives them a chance to protest. And this is why UKIP won the majority in the last European Union elections that we had. You were talking about basically the way that they're trying to do the dirty on us and keep us in the European Union. So it's just Brexit in name only. And a lot of this, they've been saying that, well, this is what Labour have been saying. They've been saying that it's all to do with Theresa May's red lines. And this really infuriates me. They keep saying, oh, Theresa May won't go back on her red lines, as if she just plucked these red lines out of thin air or something. But the red lines are basically, what is Brexit? Well, Brexit, it means leaving the European Union. So what is the European Union? The European Union is a customs union, a legal union, and a political union. So if you're going to leave the European Union, you have to leave all three of those. And that's all that these supposed red lines are that Theresa May has got. And the Labour Party is saying, well, we want to stay in the customs union. Well, that means staying in the European Union. If you stay within the customs union, you have to obey all the European Union regulations. You're not able to make trade deals with anybody else. They also want to stay within the legal union as well, which basically means not leaving the EU at all. And I've been watching these talks, and I have found it quite amusing to watch them going in. You've got Jeremy Corbyn there, you've got Keir Starmer, and then you've got what appears to be Jeremy Corbyn's granddaughter. I think she's doing work experience as the shadow business secretary, Rebecca Long Bailey, and she just looks so out of place. And it just makes me think, you know, if the Labour Party were ever to get voted in, I mean, you'd have retards and school children that were running the country. And a lot of this is because of their diversity quotas. They're desperate to get females in as MPs, and they're basically taking anyone that wears a skirt will be able to get a job within the Labour Party, and they'll put them in a position in the country where people will always vote Labour, and you've ended up with lots of really, really incompetent people. And that is what we would get if the Labour Party were to be voted in. You think about Diane Abbott as well, whose IQ trips her up every time that we see her on the television. But yeah, just actually watching them walking in, it just made me laugh looking at them. It's like, oh, this is Jeremy Corbyn's dream team, is it? You know, a little girl and Keir Starmer, and they're all sitting there looking important. And the girl is just looking like she's so out of place. She doesn't know quite what she's supposed to be doing. Keir Starmer and Jeremy Corbyn are writing things down. And this is the same woman who has said, when she was asked about this no deal Brexit, she said, well, we have to have a no deal Brexit because that's what the European Union want. I mean, nothing about what Britain wants. Like, she's so incompetent. You must have seen her on the television, Max. Rebecca Longbaby.
No, actually, I haven't seen that actually. So that's news to me. But it sounds very amusing, nonetheless.
Yeah, she's straight out of high school, basically, and she's there in this really important position, shadow business secretary. But I can't see that even if they did have a general election, I can't see that people would vote for Labour because people would be so against it. But this is the position that we're in. They've got us over a barrel. I mean, as you said, the Conservative Party activists, they are refusing to actually go out and support the Conservative Party. They're refusing to campaign for the party, and donations have dried up because members feel that Theresa May has betrayed them over Brexit and the government has completely lost touch with voters. Council candidates have warned. In a letter to the Prime Minister, more than 100 current and would-be Tory councillors state that they are unable to muster the volunteers needed to effectively fight next month's local elections because belief in the party they joined is gone. The Conservatives are on course to lose control of councils across the country. Theresa May has been warned as UKIP returns from the dead on the back of mounting anger over a delay to Brexit. Council leaders have told the Sunday Telegraph they are preparing for heavy losses in the local election amid fears voters are turning on the party for failing to take the UK out of the European Union on time. They warn that Tory councils in leave voting heartlands, including Peterborough and Southend-on-Sea, will be fighting for survival and could see their majorities wiped out in May. Their concerns have been echoed by Education Minister Nadeem Zahawi, who apparently yesterday warned that Mrs. May has she's pretty much destroyed the Conservative Party here. But they're actually going on strike. They're not even going to go out and help the party. And yet the other option to that, if they don't do that, means, you know, that we could end up with this Marxist Jeremy Corbyn in, she's now pretty much handed over responsibility to Brexit over to him. I mean, the only way out of this really is to just leave the EU without a deal, which is what the majority of the country want. It's what the majority of the Conservative Party members want. It's what the majority of everybody wants, apart from these traitors that are in Parliament. Oh, yes. And last week, on top of all this, a massive sewage pipe burst above the chamber where they were all talking, and they all got drenched with sewage. Which I thought really...
I noticed that Uri Geller apparently has claimed responsibility for using his mental powers in order to bend the pipes, and which made me chuckle because I wondered how he'd react if the Palace of Westminster sent him the bill for fixing all these pipes on the basis of his confession. But there we are.
He's also said that he's telepathically affecting Theresa May as well. He's taken credit for the fact that she's refusing to leave without a deal now. I mean, she's always said before, deal or no deal, we will be leaving on March the 12th. And she said that 108 times, that we would definitely be leaving. This is the reason for this appeal being taken out to the High Court. Is because it's been written into law that was when we would leave. All the MPs signed up to it. I think 85% of MPs signed this Act of Parliament, and there's been nothing done to actually undo that Act of Parliament. All they've done is go to the EU and say, well, can we stay for a bit longer? Which goes against, it goes against the law. And this court case is being held up as like the mirror image of Gina Miller's one that you'll remember from a couple of years back, this black woman, Gina Miller, that held everything up and said that Parliament had to vote on this. Once the deal was done, Parliament had to vote on it. And that was done a couple of years back, and that was upheld. So now we've got to see whether the English Democrats can win this. But either way, I think we stand to win, because we will have EU elections with Eurosceptics, or we will have leaving without a deal. The third way that May is doing, this is the way that we wouldn't win, is if she does this deal with Corbyn and passes the bill with all the Labour votes instead of her own party's votes. And this is something like this has never happened before, that the leader of the party that they're supposed to represent has just engaged in total treason against those members, which is what she's doing. I guess another option could be the Queen could step in. I mean, she still has that prerogative. But,
yeah, I think the Queen could step in. I wouldn't hold my breath as far as that's concerned, though. But this is perhaps a good point to introduce the speeches that have recently been made in the European Parliament by Patrick O'Flynn, who used to be a member of UKIP, but he's resigned from UKIP, but he still belongs to the same European Union grouping as UKIP. And it sort of just came to my attention earlier on this week that he'd made these speeches, which seemed to me to be very apposite. So there was one speech he made, which was to the European Parliament, which is at a meeting being held in Strasbourg. And this is on the 3rd of April this year, where he says it's in response to a speech made by the Prime Minister of the Slovak Republic, Peter Pellegrini. And he says, thank you, Mr. Pellegrini. This debate is about the future of Europe, but the blunt truth is that the EU only has a future if it learns to respect the wishes of the peoples across Europe to maintain the sovereignty of their nations. In my country, that manifested itself in the glorious vote for Brexit in Peterborough, where I am based. More than 60% voted to leave. Until yesterday, the grand old men of the EU pretended to respect that. But last night, Mr. Juncker himself warned the British people that unless the Brexit in name only withdrawal agreement is accepted, there may be no Brexit at all. With a craven British Prime Minister sitting next to him like some lapdog, the EU's top man sought to call the British people to heel. What arrogance, what conceit. You should have let us go with goodwill. Instead, you've decided to make an example of us to frighten the others. The EU clearly has the measure of Mrs. May, but the British people will never surrender to these imperial ambitions. So that's quite interesting in the sense that he's pointing out that the EU are very keen for us to have this Brexit in name withdrawal agreement, because from their point of view, if we leave the European Union without a deal, they would regard that as being something which would be a bit of a disaster for the EU, and it would also encourage other EU countries that are dissatisfied with the overbearing nature of the European parliamentary system to also seek to leave. But if we stay within the European Union, then it means that what will happen is that we'll have to have European elections, and those European elections, as you've just been very rightly saying, would probably result in a very significantly large number of anti-EU candidates getting elected. I can imagine that it would be a bit of a feast day for parties like UKIP in the north of England, particularly where there are lots of Labour supporters who are very dissatisfied with the European Union as well. And it would probably only be in places like Scotland and around London that there would be that the pro-European Union candidates would hold their own. And in large swathes of the rest of the country, particularly if conservative party workers go on strike, then we'll see the majorities of any Conservative candidates slashed in a general election. But we could also see large numbers of UKIP candidates getting elected on the basis of a protest vote against the Conservatives and also a protest vote against Labour. And so the European Parliament would have probably several times as many anti-EU MEPs than it has now if we stay in the European Union. So they probably don't want us to actually stay in the European Union, but on the other hand, they don't want us to completely leave. But what they would like us to have is this relationship that Theresa May has negotiated, and that's probably why they've given her so much, have been so patient in extending the period of time for her to get this agreement over and done with, because what they really want is to have a situation where the UK is kept subordinate to the European Union as, I said earlier on, a kind of a satellite to the European Union, but in a situation where we have to obey all of their laws, but we have no representation in the European Parliament. That would probably be the best outcome for them, because I can see that already the anti-EU candidates or the anti-EU MEPs that exist within the European Parliament are already making a nuisance of themselves as far as the EU is concerned. They're causing a lot of embarrassment to Jean-Claude Juncker and others, and he probably wouldn't want to have us wouldn't want to have lots more people like Nigel Farage and Patrick O'Flynn in the in that particular chamber. If I go on to just talk you through the second speech that Patrick O'Flynn made, and this was during a debate on Britain's withdrawal from the European Union. And so he's introduced by the Madam President, and he says, "Thank you, Madam President. Mr. Juncker, despite your determination to give a punishment beating to the United Kingdom, the current impasse is not exclusively your fault. It has been your misfortune almost as much as ours to be dealing with the worst Prime Minister in British history, someone who stands for nothing and can deliver nothing. And someone is so passive about having sand kicked in their face, it takes a restrained kind of bully to walk off the beach. And we know from its dealings with Greece and others that the Commission is not a restrained kind of bully. But you would be making a terrible mistake to assume that Mrs. May is representative of the British people. You have men like Tony Blair whispering in your ear the dream of the British suddenly embracing your project of integration. Do not believe it. We're a different kind of European nation. We have a different history, a different geography, and different modern networks. So you should ask why Blair, in his pomp, did not risk a referendum on EU membership. You should ask why Brown could not risk a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty. And you should ask why Cameron, when he was forced to hold a referendum on membership, lost it to the greatest number of British people ever to vote for anything. And finally, you should ask yourself why, after being threatened with no food, no water, no medicines, and no jobs, the latest polls show that more British people wish to leave the European Union with no deal next Friday than to remain. Once you've asked these questions, then you should look ahead. You should imagine how Mrs. May's successor would seek to rebuild the shattered Tory support before the next general election, if we have not left. He or she will be leading a party whose potential support is overwhelmingly formed of Leave voters. Do not expect consistency from the Conservatives, by the way. The tooting popular Marxist front will not last. Instead, the answer is obvious. Guy Verhofstadt is right. Verhofstadt is right. The successor will seek to rebuild support by making your lives a misery through vetoes and political sabotage, by rejecting every proposed development of your project. So reject another extension, resolve that Brexit will happen on World Trade Organization terms next Friday, and then negotiate constructively to tie up the loose ends after that. Do this and we can still be your best customer, but lock us in and we will be your worst nightmare." And I thought that was a particularly good speech.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? This withdrawal deal, it basically means staying within the EU, but then not having any say in what goes on there. And the European Union MPs, they do have very little say anyway, but they can make themselves quite an irritant to the European Union Commission, which is what all these Eurosceptic MPs will do if we take part in these elections. But did you, this actual letter that Theresa May sent, did you hear about the vote that took place that enabled her to send this begging letter? It won by one vote. That's all that it won by in the House of Commons, was one vote. And that vote was cast by the disgraced black criminal Labour MP who was in prison, that was let out recently on a tag, and she broke her curfew to make that vote. So she broke her probation conditions to go in there and cast that vote, and it was her vote that enabled Theresa May to go in and ask to actually stay within the EU for a bit longer. And that's just really shocking in itself, that somebody that's nothing to do with Britain, you know, knows nothing about our politics, our democracy, her ancestors did nothing for the country, nothing at all, and she's lucky enough to be voted in as a Labour MP, and the people that she's supposed to be serving, the laws that she's supposed to be making and honouring and upholding, she breaks them, and she lies to the court. And she's a criminal. She's a jailed criminal for breaking the law. And it's actually her, it's her vote, which was made whilst breaking the law, once again, breaking her curfew, that actually overturned the will of the British people. Just like it was this black Gina Miller that overturned the will of the British people 2 years back when she took this to court and said that this goes against democracy and they have to have a vote on this deal at the end of it. I mean, once again, diversity throws a spanner in the works. I don't know if you want to add any more to that or about this black Labour MP, or we could move on to this Sultan of Brunei and this new Sharia law that he's bringing in Brunei, Max.
Well, just to sum up, really, that Theresa May made a big thing about no deal being better than a bad deal when she first became the Prime Minister. And now we're in a situation where, quite clearly, as far as the British people is concerned, her deal is worse than either staying in the European Union or a no deal Brexit. Hers is the very least attractive of those propositions because it, as we've already discussed, it locks us into the European Union and locks us into their orbit of influence, where they determine all the regulations and all the legislation that will apply to us, whilst at the same time it prevents us from having any say. Whereas at least if we're in the European Union, then we're not effectively locked in by a specific agreement trying to lock us in. By the same token, if we were to leave the European Union with no deal, that would be the best option altogether. And so I think we need to be clear in our minds that no deal is what we're after. If it's not no deal, then we're probably better off staying in the European Union, because it leaves us in our current position and leaves us in a position where we can try again at some future date to get out of the European Union. If we leave under May's terms, then it means we're going to be locked into the European Union, and a future British government is going to then have to break that agreement. And this is one of the things that I mentioned to you last week, that a basic rule of British constitutional law is that no parliament can lock in a future parliament to a specific action. No future parliament can be dictated to by an existing parliament, effectively. And so, therefore, as far as our parliament is concerned, we can break any treaty, we can break any agreement that we've made. Of course, there will be political consequences to that, but we legally can, you know, a newly elected parliament can abolish any agreements that an old corrupt parliament has made prior to it coming into existence. And so this is the thing that we have to focus our minds on, the fact that we're not bound, even though legally the European Union is trying to bind us to them. Any such agreement is, according to British constitutional principles invalid, and we can break that if a future parliament decides that the agreement that we've entered into is bad for our people.
Well, that's the ridiculous thing, isn't it? I mean, they could just leave with no deal. And then have a general election, and one of the, you know, one of these parties could have an election manifesto of rejoining the EU, and then we'd see, you know, what the will of the people was. I mean, that, again, that seems to me a very sensible option, but it hasn't been put forward by anyone. As I say, we'll just have to wait and see what happens. There are three choices basically, aren't there? There's leave with no deal, which is good for us. Have the EU elections, which is good for us, Eurosceptics in the EU. Or the third way, which is not good for us, is the soft Brexit, which is basically putting Jeremy Corbyn in charge of Brexit, which is what the Tory party are rebelling against. There really hasn't been a lot of other news in Britain over the last week that's particularly newsworthy. But I did notice that there was a demonstration yesterday. And I'm not really sure why it was on the news, because there was only about 100 people there. They had a couple of famous faces there. They had Emily Thornberry there, who this obese lesbian Labour politician that has mocked British patriots, especially British patriots that like flying the England flag, and also the homosexual celebrity Peter Tatchell, the Australian. He was there as well. And they were protesting against the Sultan of Brunei. So they're protesting against what somebody else is doing in another country miles away from here. And the reason why they're protesting him is because he's instituted Sharia law in his country, something which he's quite entitled to do in a sovereign nation. And the reason why they don't like Sharia law is because he is reinstituting the law against abortion, adultery, and sodomy. And these are all laws that we had in Britain at one time, not that far back. And he's basically instituting the death penalty for those crimes, which is in tune with Sharia law. I believe it's the same thing that they have in Saudi Arabia. It's the same thing that they have in Pakistan. So I'm not really sure why it is they've made such a point of making such a fuss about this same law coming in Brunei. They've said, well, this is the same law that the Islamic State have, but it's Sharia law. It's the same law that any Muslim country either puts into practice or ends up with having lots of terrorist acts happening within their country until they do put it into practice, because that is Orthodox Islam, is basically following Sharia law. And they basically had this huge protest yesterday, and it was outside one of these hotels that this rich Sultan of Brunei owns. And they had Emily Thornberry, and she was saying, what is shameful is that our royal family puts royal ties before human rights. The Queen has said today that the royal family will not sever ties with the Sultan. Well, why should the Queen sever ties with somebody that she sees as on the same level as she is? Because the Sultan, I believe, he's the richest man in the world. He sort of drives around in golden Rolls Royces and has huge harems and all the rest of it. But there were cries of shame from the crowd when Mr. Tatchell said the royal family were not going to cut ties. Shadow Foreign Secretary Emily Thornberry told the crowd that if the laws are not revoked, Brunei should be chucked out of the Commonwealth. She added, any hatred against anyone is hatred against all of us. Our fight is with the Sultan of Brunei. Our fight is with this terrible law. We say no. The new laws in the Southeast Asian country came into effect on April the 3rd amidst an international outcry. Under the new laws, which apply to children and foreigners, even if they are not Muslim, those found guilty of gay sex could be stoned to death or whipped. Sultan Hassani Bolkiah instituted the code in 2014 to bolster the influence of Islam in the oil-rich monarchy of around 430,000 people, two-thirds of whom are Muslim. And it's interesting here that they're saying, you know, people in that country, even if they're not Muslim, they still have to obey the law. And that's as if saying that there should be two laws. There should be one law for the Muslims and one law for everyone else. And of course, that is what Muslims say in Britain. They want to have one law for them and one law for everyone else. And eventually they want everybody else to obey their law. But they already have these Sharia courts in Britain that are operating a parallel legal system that the European Union have said Sharia law is not compatible with Western law. I believe the UN, they did an investigation into it and said that it's not compatible with Western law. And yet in Britain, we have these Sharia law courts. So we are actually well on our way to this. But I don't, you know, I don't see how these people can claim that they're not supremacists when they want to interfere in the legal system in another country over the other side of the world and say, well, if you're not Muslim, then you shouldn't have to obey this law over there. And also, I don't understand the hypocrisy where they single out Brunei, but they won't say anything about Saudi Arabia or Pakistan. It just seems very selective. Why do you think it is, Matt? I mean, have you got any ideas why it is that they're singling out Brunei for this when you've got the same law in other Islamic countries? Do you know anything about this country?
Well, I suspect it's because the Sultan of Brunei is one of the world's richest men, and so a lot of these protesters are going to be left-wing protesters, and that's what they will see as the difference, that they will be prepared to turn a blind eye to Islam being applied rigidly in poor Muslim countries, but they probably expect that because Brunei is a wealthier state, and because the Sultan of Brunei is a wealthier person, that they would expect him to be a liberal, and they just can't understand why he isn't a liberal and why he is somebody who is a supporter of traditional Islam.
They just have to push their views onto everyone, don't they? This progressive ideals.
You're quite right. It is a form of supremacy. It's sort of the liberal mindset supremacy, where they've got this idea that only their view matters, and that anybody else that has a view that's different from theirs is a nasty person that has to be shut up and can't be allowed to have freedom of speech and can't be allowed to participate in the governing of their country. Even though the Sultan of Brunei is only creating law in his own country, he's not seeking to force his laws on the rest of the world. They see it as their prerogative to try to force the liberal attitudes that they've made prevail amongst the metropolitan elite in this country. They see it as their right to be able to force those same beliefs upon the Sultan of Brunei, and as I say, it is a form of supremacy.
And they've said, well, look, we're not expecting everybody else to go along with this, but we just ask that you respect our laws in our country. I mean, what's wrong with that? If you want to go to Brunei, obey the laws of Brunei. You know, if you want to come to Britain, you should obey the laws of Britain, which, you know, these ethnic minorities don't think that they should have to obey the laws, and this newspaper appears to think that's perfectly fine as well, that, you know, if you're Muslim, you should be able to have different laws in countries to everybody else. But there was another piece in this article that I thought was interesting. Ahead of the demonstration, the University of Oxford said it would reconsider its decision to award an honorary degree to the Sultan. In a statement on Saturday, the university said it shared the international revulsion. But of course, it's not international revulsion, because all the Islamic countries support this. It said it shared the international revulsion of the laws, and that the decision to confer the honorary degree of civil law by diploma to Sultan Hassan ad-Bolkiah in 1993 would be reconsidered through its established process. But it stressed no one had the right to summarily rescind it, and added, we also believe in due process. Just as nobody has a right to confer an honorary degree, nobody has a right to summarily rescind it. The decision to confer this degree 26 years ago was recommended by a committee and approved by council and by congregation at the time. We will reconsider this decision through our established process in light of the information now available, as other British universities are doing. Now, as far as I understand it, when you get awarded an honorary degree, it's supposed to be exactly the same as if you had worked for that degree. And for them to say that if somebody isn't politically correct, they can have their qualifications removed from them, they can have their degrees removed from them, I find that a little bit unsettling. I mean, the university is saying that they're not going to do that. They're going to actually put it through a committee first. But just the fact that people think that he should have his degree removed from him, and they think that that is, you know, that's an acceptable thing to demand just because somebody isn't politically correct. You know, I think that's really wrong. You know, it's like saying if you have a professor and he's a professor of psychology or a professor of biology, and he says, well, there are quite obviously differences between the races. That's what the information tells us. You know, they could say, well, we're going to remove your qualifications from you for not being politically correct.
Well, I think this shows the hypocrisy really of the liberal left. They have these sort of campaigning slogans of, you know, diversity is our strength. And they use that slogan when it suits them, in circumstances where it suits them. But when diversity acts against them, i.e. when there is diversity of opinion, when somebody actually wants to hold an opinion which is different from their opinion, then all of a sudden diversity isn't a strength, and diversity is something that they have to try and stamp out. And as I say, it is a rank hypocrisy on their part that they want to do this. And also it's rank hypocrisy because they, as you pointed out earlier on, there is no consistency in their behaviour. And so whilst they are attacking the Sultan of Brunei over the fact that he holds these traditional Muslim beliefs, they're not similarly criticising and campaigning outside the mosques in this country to also preach traditional Islamic beliefs. And that's really what they should be doing if they were going to be consistent. But they won't do that in this country because they know that, as far as the Labour Party is concerned, that they rely upon the votes from ethnic minorities, a large proportion of which are made up of Muslims, in order to get their candidates elected. And so they will just keep quiet about what's going on in this country, and they'll just campaign in a situation where it's purely symbolic, rather than that there being any consistent approach on their part. They are using the symbolism of attacking the Sultan of Brunei, knowing that effectively, or despite the fact that there's nothing much they can do about it because the Sultan of Brunei is wealthy enough to just ignore them anyway, and in all probability he probably couldn't give a toss whether they take his honorary degree away from him or not. And in the situations where they could actually make a difference, if they were to campaign vigorously against the holding of traditional Islamic beliefs in this country, then they probably could make some kind of a difference. But it would stir up a bit of a hornet's nest for them, and that's why they don't want to do it.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, it's not a fringe belief amongst Islam that sodomy should be punished by death. I mean, they've got, at the moment, there's another news story that's being covered up in Birmingham. You've got all these protests at a school there that was teaching that homosexuality is good to primary school children. And all the Muslims have pulled their children out of the school, and they're all protesting outside the school. And it's been going on for a month or so now. And the press has just been covering it up and not saying anything about it. And actually, over there in Brunei, there haven't been any protests. The Brunei people are quite happy to have this law. I mean, nobody's asked them if they want this law or not. It's just the West imposing its values on them. I mean, they don't even have to pay income tax over there. They're all very well looked after. And two-thirds of them are Muslim, and the rest of them are obviously very conservative-minded, because they aren't protesting. And I've seen quite a few messages from people in Brunei saying, look, just keep your nose out. It's our business. It's none of your business. We don't tell you what laws you should have in your countries. How dare you tell us what laws we should have in ours? So,
it's religious and moral imperialism, isn't it, that's been advocated by the liberal left in this country, which again just demonstrates the inconsistency and the hypocrisy of what they're doing. You know, they speak out and campaign against all forms of imperialism in other respects, and anything they don't like, they try to link it with imperialism in some respect, and yet here they are in trying to impose religious and moral imperialism on a foreign country that just happens to have a different belief system to the one that they hold dear. And I think that we should remind the liberal left in this country that, you know, that if they believe that diversity is a strength, then they should agree with there being a and the validity of a diversity of opinion, not just a diversity of opinion where there are issues relating to either traditional or more liberal forms of Islam, but there should be diversity of opinion allowed and promoted in this country over all other issues, so that they should stop campaigning for the banning and the abolition of people who hold right-wing nationalistic views, and that they should claim that it enriches our country that there are people who believe things that are different from what they believe. It enriches our country that we've got nationalists in this country that have views that are diametrically opposed to the liberal left elite. And it's that diversity of opinion, that enrichment, that makes our country stronger. That's what they should be telling themselves. And it's just a pity that they are rank hypocrites and that they can't actually rationalise to that extent.
Yeah, they can't work it out for themselves, can they? They talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. They just expose themselves as hypocrites all the time. And as I say, there was only about 100 people at this demonstration, but somehow it managed to get itself on the national news, and it was being shown on the BBC every 15 minutes yesterday, trying to make a big point about it. But we also have had some other news last week following the knife crime epidemic. We've been told that they're now going to start punishing teachers for the children. If the children get involved in knife crime, it's the teachers that are going to be punished. We also had Theresa May's meeting. She had a big summit on knife crime and said that they were going to actually give a bit more money to the police. And also, this came in just over the weekend. Shops are going to stop selling knives. The UK's sixth largest supermarket operator, Cooperative Group, has stopped selling single kitchen knives in a response to the surge in fatal stabbings across the country. The move was announced by the company on Friday, although the knives had actually been pulled from the stores around 3 weeks ago. We've launched our Safer Colleague, Safer Community campaign to support colleague safety and help identify the causes of community crime. This has seen us remove kitchen knives from sale in our stores, Co-op CEO Steve Morrell said. A similar move was announced by Walmart-owned UK supermarket chain Asda a month ago. The chain is to pull all single knives from its stores by the end of April. So they've identified the cause of community crime, and that is kitchen knives. I mean, well, what do they think happens in prisons where they don't actually have any knives at all? Do they just not have any stabbings? No, people will make up their own weapons and use them to stab each other. This isn't going to do anything at all. And again, this just shows this mentality of ignoring what the real causes of the problems are and pretending that it's something else. I mean, what are they expecting people to use to cut the food up on their plate with, if they're not going to sell knives? And this is just, you know, I would never have believed this. If someone said a few years ago, oh, they're actually going to ban selling kitchen knives because people would be stabbing one another so much, I would just have not believed it. But this is what it's like living in a multicultural country. You end up having things like knives banned. I mean, we're going to be mocked all around the world for this, Max. Have you got a knife? Have you got a license for that kitchen knife? I mean, what are they going to do next?
Why just stop at knives? You know, there are things, there are all sorts of utensils that you can buy from shops now that are designed like meat tenderizers, that are like a sort of a mallet with little pointy bits on the end that they I'm sure that If the people that are committing the knife crime were denied access to knives, they might resort to other kinds of weapons. They might even resort to using forks and stabbing each other with forks. And then we'd have to have a situation where forks would be banned as well. And they might buy spoons and sharpen the edges of spoons on a whetstone and then start trying to slash each other with spoons. And then we'd have to have spoons banned. And then we'd have to have a situation where supermarkets were only able to sell food that was in bite-sized chunks, or which was soft and in little jars like baby food, so you could eat it without having to, you know, cut it. Or and in fact, you wouldn't even be able to sell it in jars, because people would then be forced to eat with their fingers, because they wouldn't have spoons or forks. People would have to like dip their fingers into the jar, and eventually we'd end up eating like sort of primitive tribes people in the jungle somewhere, you know, where they sort of mix up a bit of paste on a leaf and then just kind of smear it into their mouth.
Ridiculous. I mean,
you know, it's, you know, when you sort of follow this sort of line of stupid logic, that's where that kind of thinking leads to. Really, what we've got to do is just to make people more responsible, to focus on the actual causes of the knife crime, and to clamp down on those causes of knife crime instead of trying to remove the weapons. It's just, you know, it's just silly. And things like screwdrivers as well, you know, they would stop anybody from buying a screwdriver. And so, you know,
they're used all the time for as a weapon. I mean, it's basically using tools as weapons. I mean, for a long time now, they've said, well, you cannot actually have a knife as a tool anymore. We're going to ban knives in public. And I mean, a knife is a tool. I mean, it's possibly the first tool that man ever invented. Was some kind of flint knife, and they used to give out pen knives to children as awards. You know, within my lifetime, you used to get a pen knife at school as an award for doing well. And now, because we've got people living within our country that didn't actually create a civilization for themselves and are essentially still savages in many ways, and they show that by using this tool to stab one another with, it's been turning to a weapon. And now they're basically saying, well, you can't have them anyway. You can't just not have knives in public, but we're going to stop selling them in the shops. And the reason why they started throwing bleach in one another's faces and acid in one another's faces is because of this not allowed to have knives in public. This is not going to solve the problem at all. It's just going to cause Britain to be mocked. I mean, you can understand that there is a problem. I mean, there is a serious problem. Knife homicides in England and Wales hit a record high during the 12 months up to March 2018, with the deaths destroying lives and shattering communities. 285 killings were committed, the biggest number since records began. 285 killings. The report released by the Office of National Statistics shows that homicides caused by a knife or sharp instrument increased by a whopping 73 on the same period for 2016-2017. The previous high was recorded in 2008, when 268 victims died. David Lammy, the Labour MP for Tottenham, blamed poor government policy and its failed war on drugs, which has allowed international criminal gangs to pimp out vulnerable black teenagers as drug runners. He insists that violence is not being committed by young black people because they were born violent, is because too many are forced into desperate lives of crime. So what about the blacks out in Africa then, that are killing one another? Have they been forced into desperate lives of crime? Were they like that before we went over there? Were they being forced into crime? Were they being pimped out? You know, the reason for that, it's not that they're born violent, it's just that this is the way that they are. This is, you know, when you have a low IQ and when you have a quick temper and you don't have much control over your emotions, and you're not capable of thinking of abstract concepts and thinking of the way that it hurts society to hurt somebody else as well, then this is the sort of thing that happens. It's not they're born violent, it's that they're born black. I mean, it's like we have to look at them the same way as we look at dogs and cats. You know, one isn't better than the other or more violent than the other. They're both different species, and they have different characters, basically. And the blacks have a different character to the whites, and we see this all the time. And the only way you're going to solve this problem is to remove them. And if you can't remove them, you should segregate them, because at least then the white people wouldn't be the victims. We've had a lot of white victims of this crime. I think at the moment, I was reading yesterday, it was 2/3 black victims and 1/3 white victims. And that's obviously that blacks are more likely to be the victims, but blacks are also far more likely to be the perpetrators. But those white victims, it wouldn't have happened to them if they weren't living in a multicultural country. And you can look back 100 years ago and you can see that there was as much crime as we have in a day now, you would get in a year back then.
Yeah, I was going to say that back in the 1930s, when we had the Great Depression, there weren't large numbers of young people in this country that were forced into this kind of crime in those times. And it is something that accompanies the creation of a multicultural society. I mean, even people who are of a left-wing disposition, who are of an egalitarian disposition, and who desperately don't want to admit that there could possibly be some sort of racial differences between the different racial groups, even they must eventually admit that this kind of crime, knife crime, and crimes related to drugs and related to the exploitation of vulnerable people, prostitution, all these kinds of these forms of crime are prevalent in multicultural societies and not prevalent, or at least they're very, very much less frequent in countries that are where there is one ethnic group and one cultural and racial group. And so the thing that is the problem here is that our politicians are determined to create a multicultural and multiracial society, irrespective of the fact that they know that such societies inevitably are dysfunctional societies and have all sorts of crimes that are associated with people becoming, I think we sort of went through this to a certain extent last week, but people when they wander into an area of the country that is dominated by a different cultural or ethnic group or religious group, they feel disoriented and they feel disaffected. And when they're forced to live in a such an area where they are in a minority, they have fewer feelings of charity towards the population in general. They are less forgiving of the other populations. They tend to harbour more ideas that they are perhaps being held down, or that a glass ceiling is being imposed on them, or they are in some way disadvantaged by the group that is in the majority. And so because they have these deep-seated resentments and this general disaffection and disorientation, it makes them more vulnerable to engaging in criminal activity.
So what you're saying,
got to do is got to dismantle the multicultural society that recent politicians have been trying to create, and return to the kind of situation that existed in Britain in the late 40s and the early 50s, where overwhelmingly our society was made up of one ethnic group, the indigenous British people. And if we return to that situation, then levels of crime would return to the levels that they were in the 1950s as well, with burglaries being much less frequent, with there being virtually no drug crime, with there being virtually no prostitution, with there being virtually no interracial, well, there wouldn't be any interracial crime in those days because there weren't interracial groups. That's what we've got to get. That's the common sense that we've got to try and inculcate in people so that we can fix the broken society that's been created around us.
Do you think then that there's more chance of this violence in multicultural areas than there would be in Africa, where they're all black? Say you've got an area that's just filled with blacks. What you're saying there is because you've got like these different cultures there, you feel closer to your own people and you resent the other people that are there because you're feeling as if you're being put down by them, you're being persecuted by them, what have you. So there is more friction. So do you think there is, that there would be less violence if these areas were all black and didn't have white people, Chinese and Muslims in them?
Well, what we should do is avoid this idea that all black people belong to exactly the same race, which isn't the case. If you look across Africa, there are naturally different that there are racial differences across Africa, and some of the non-white groups in one part of Africa will be genetically very dissimilar to the non-white groups that inhabit another part of Africa. And the violence that we see in Africa is still at a much, much higher level than it is in Europe, etc. And that, again, could be down to the fact that the because of the great genetic diversity that we're always being told about that exists in Africa, that this same disorientation, disaffection exists within communities which ostensibly to us as outsiders just look like, you know, a homogenous black society. But as far as that black society is concerned, it's riven with all sorts of different divisions where you've got these different tribal groups. And it's interesting that when there was the genocide in Rwanda, it was the Hutus and the Tutsis, I believe, that were two tribal groups that were massacring each other. You know, there are lots of instances where, you know, what appears to be black people fighting almost identical black people from our perspective, what you've actually got is, you know, one ethnic group within the black community in, you know, an African country that is at war with another ethnic or racial group that where they can see the difference, but it's not necessarily visible to us.
Yeah, I
always remember that there was an anthropology program that used to be on television. I can't remember which channel it was on, but it had a guy who was a really nice guy who was ex-special forces, and he went out to South America, and he went out to Africa, and he went out to Southeast Asia, and he lived with tribes, and he lived with them for long enough so that they would allow him to go through their manhood ceremony. And he did this with each of these tribes. And I remember that he went to live with a tribe in Africa, and this tribe lived in a valley, and they raised cattle, and every so often they would go on raiding parties where they would go over the sort of mountain pass into the next valley, and they would steal cattle from the people that lived in that valley and then bring the cattle back. And and he was talking to one of the people about the this sort of enmity with the people in the next valley, and was sort of asking him what the what was the I can't remember the exact
reason for
the question
it.
Was, but it was words to the effect of what is the greatest day of your life. And this chap turned around to him and says, the greatest day of my life was when our tribe got our Kalashnikovs and we went over the into the valley of the people next to us and we slaughtered them. Which I just thought was
that's where it
amazingly
comes from, isn't it?
Funny that should happen.
That's where it comes from. It's just a natural behavior of theirs. I think you're right there, because I can remember seeing reports in South Africa that the South African blacks or the Johannesburg blacks, they were rioting and killing these other blacks that had come there from elsewhere. I mean, the reason why I ask it is, you know, what would be best for them? What would be best for the blacks to actually reduce the amount of slaughter that goes on in these multicultural centres? Would it be better with the blacks among the blacks? And I do think it would be, because I do think that there is extra friction there between the different cultures that are there. So it would benefit them as well as it would benefit us. So, you know, segregation is just the natural way of all things in the natural world. Anyway, thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Aryan Britannia for you on Monday. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.
You are listening for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.